Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
And the Ben Jarofsky Show starts right now. It is Friday, June 25th, live from my apartment and his attic. This is the Ben Jarofsky Show. I am DJ Nate, filling in for the one and only Dr. D. Today on the program, we have the great Richard Steele. And now, your host, Chicago Reader columnist, Ben Jarofsky.
Hello, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this Richard Steele Friday, and here's why. We're calling it Richard Steele Friday because sitting right next to me, almost on top of me, is my old friend Richard Steele.
Hey, hey.
It's like, I told him it was like those Rolling Stone concerts where Mick and Keith share a mic. So I'm going to take these headphones off. There's no reason for me to be wearing them. Take this out there. So anyway, usually on Friday, as everybody knows, we do Oh What a Week It Was, where Dr. D, Dennis, goes through the week's news and I riff on him. But since Dr. D is on vacation, I thought it'd be a good idea to bring my old friend Richard Steele in. And he was so nice enough to drive all the way to my house. It's the first time, Richard, anybody's ever been in my house to do a show.
And I'm a fill-in?
Yes. You're. Oh, wait. Let's edit that out. Richard Steele is no fill-in, okay? But Richard comes on from time to time anyway. We have this thing where, like, he identifies the stories that he's interested in talking about, and I identify the stories that I'm interested in talking about, and we just talk. Because we are two champion talkers. And just for folks who may not remember, I'm going to give you a crash course on Richard Steele, the legendary. He hates when I say it because stop calling me old. He was a disc jockey for many years at WVON. He was a radio personality I forgot the name of that station. What's the name of that station?
B103 and WBEZ.
Yeah, that's the
Chicago
one.
Chicago Public Radio, NPR.
Yes, that's the one I was teasingly forgetting. And people don't know that. I'd like to remind him of this. He was also the front man with our mutual friend Richard Pegee for many shows at Taste. Richard being in the back room spinning the records. Richard Pegee would be, and Richard Steele would be up front telling anecdotes, telling stories. So he follows news, he follows music, he follows culture, and we talk about all that when you're on. So welcome back.
Good to be here.
Welcome to my home, my humble home.
Yeah, this is nice. This is nice, you know. This is where you hide, right?
Yes, where I hide.
It's great.
It's going to get really hot up here. That air conditioner works periodically, so just a word of warning. This is like old school. All right, Richard and I were just talking. We're sitting at my kitchen table talking about what we wanted to talk about, a mixture of national and local news. And let me point out that we realized that the sentencing in the Derek Chauvin trial is probably going to come down while we're on the air.
Probably,
so,
yeah.
So I'll be keeping my eye on the phone for that one, Richard, and we can get into that as well. I'm going to start the thing that's burning on my brain right now, and I'd love to get your thoughts as a longtime Chicagoan, is the performance of Mayor Lori Lightfoot the other day at the city council meeting. When was that? Wednesday, where she left the rostrum, left the podium. First, she recessed the meeting, called a recess, and then walked down to the floor and went right into the face of Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor, who was on the show yesterday explaining what went down. So if anybody wants to hear Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor's version of that, I urge you to check out that interview. Richard, I've never seen a mayor do that. I've been around a long time. I followed Daley, Rahm. I was even around for a brief period with Old Man Daley. He never did.
Not even the old man did that, you know. Amazing. I mean, she actually waved her finger in the alderman's face, you know, That was different.
So in your humble opinion, what do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think she's frustrated. I'm talking about the mayor now. Mm-hmm. I think she's frustrated. She's losing control, if she ever had control, of city council. You know, and the bottom line is, I thought, I supported her. I thought she was going to be a pretty good mayor. I thought she'd have a learning curve. But with her, it seems that she doesn't accept the learning curve. She's still going with, you know, what she thinks is the right thing to do, even if it's aggressive and in your face. And that's not working out too well. I mean, I was somebody who, I was convinced that she would, you know, like grow into the job. You know what I mean? I'm not so convinced at this point. And as a matter of fact, she could end up being the Jane Byrne of our era, you know, one term and out. The only saving grace at this point, and she's got, what, 2 more years?
Yeah, 2 more years.
The only saving grace at this point is I don't see anybody on the horizon. I mean, in 2 years, somebody will show up. But, I mean, she's not doing a great job. I mean, she's really, you know, you kind of give them latitude when they first start as mayor. And you say, well, at some point, you know, they'll get it. And then some of the decisions, David Brown, who's the, you know, the chief of police, he's like, okay, but you know, you kind of feel like he doesn't have a grip on it.
Yeah.
And so she's made some choices that are, you know, like, I think are not good at all. And the situation with the alderman, this was about, you know, this was about the Anjanette Taylor deal.
Anjanette Young, rather.
Mm-hmm. Where, you know, I mean, the settlement with the city was going to be $1 million. And her lawyer said, you know, that's, you know, that's, nah, it's not good enough. And I agree. I mean, for what she went through, no, I mean, that's not good enough. And so the bad news is the woman that the mayor just, well, she was going to appoint her, it has to be approved. And it hasn't been approved yet.
Yeah.
And she's the corporation counsel,
yeah.
Right?
Celia Mazza, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And she's the one who said, well, you know, look, let's walk away from that. We made the offer. It's not going to change, and so let's walk away from that and call it a day. And that did not sit well with the alderman. It did not sit well with a lot of people. Yeah. It did not sit well with me. I thought that was terrible.
Well, I thought it was, and you know, here's the thing, Richard. If the best defense I could think of for Mayor Lori Lightfoot, and as I say this, I'm not buying it. I'm just saying this is the defense that would be that she's looking out for the taxpayers. So she's trying to limit the amount of money that we as taxpayers have to pay Anjanette Young for the police raiding her house, getting the wrong house while she's stepping out of the bathroom. She's stark naked. They hold her captive in her own house, slap handcuffs on her. It's a total humiliation. And it was so obvious, like within a minute, that they had the wrong house, you know, and they still kept it going.
And they held the tape. You know, they had the tape because this happened like, what, a year and a half ago?
This happened December 2019.
You know, so, come on. You know what I mean? So, I mean, the police department was totally in the wrong. And one of the other problems, too, with this mayor is that what happened to the consent decree and all the follow up with that? You know what I mean? She was somebody who campaigned on that.
Yeah.
And so now that you look at it and say, well, how far have we gone with that? Not far. You know what I mean? So there are a lot of problems.
Well, So it's adding insult and injury. See, I'm trying to give her defense and I can't because I feel like you do.
Well, it's insult
to injury to compound the lawsuit, to play hardball, you know, and Lori Lightfoot is showing her corporation. She's a corporate lawyer. And, you know, Richard, that's how corporate lawyers play the game. They got the money behind them. They can run out the clock. You know how that game is played.
I know I thought she would. Here's what I thought about her. I thought she knew enough about city politics. She wasn't a politician. She had never held elected office. But I thought she knew enough based on her experiences, you know, as in the position that she held in city government, that she could ease into the larger picture of being the mayor, which is, you know, and let's be honest, she inherited an awful lot of problems. Why would you want to be mayor in the first place? I mean, you've got FOP to deal with the police department. You've got the teachers union, the CTU, all of those stuff, all of that stuff converged as it would for any mayor. And you have to deal with it. So I'm trying to give her the benefit of the doubt, but I'm like, this is not working.
No.
You know, so I don't know what the answer is. You know, here's what I think, too. I think that somebody who's real close to her, because she's real thin skinned. I think that somebody who's real close to her, maybe somebody can get through to her and say, listen, you need to chill. You know what I mean? And nobody, as far as I know, nobody says anything to her like that. There are no, I can't think of anybody in city council or in city politics who is close enough to her to say, to pull her coat, you know, and say, you need to check, you need to take a step back. You need to chill. I don't think there's anybody there for that.
Well, now this gets to larger, you're helping me write a column on mine. The larger problem, I think, with mayors in particular in Chicago, and I've said this before, is that we invest them with so much authority. And it's as though the Chicago mentality is all about feeling secure, most secure. If we have a powerful mayor that was somehow or other, it's almost like a godlike figure.
Yeah, but then it wasn't set up like that. It was supposed to be strong city council and weak mayor. Over the years, it changed. After Daley, the first Daley, that was out.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it wasn't set up like that.
Well, that's like everybody wants to be the first Daley. Like everybody wants to be Daddy Daley. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, the boss, you know?
Yeah.
And so here's a question I have for you. And Richard's not had an opportunity to entertain this one, but I'm going to throw this at you. And I've been thinking about this since Jeanette Taylor was on the show and Jeanette Taylor herself raised this issue. So what happened that set off Mayor Lightfoot at the meeting was when two aldermen deferred and published the matter. So they used their authority they had to put off until another time a city council vote on Mesa as corporation council, okay? But as I said, there were two aldermen who did that. One was Alderman Raymond Lopez from the 15th Ward. And the second one, he was the one who said, proposed to postpone till the next meeting. And it has to be seconded. And it was seconded by Jeanette Taylor.
Right.
And Jeanette Taylor said, Ben, you notice Lori Lightfoot didn't go up to Raymond Lopez and put her finger in everything. Yeah. He walked right by Raymond Lopez and went up to me. Yeah. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, the alderman, brought in the race issue as part of that. You know what I mean? So I don't know if that's necessarily what the situation is, although there's still, some reverberation from her declaration about reporters. Which I think was a big mistake when she said, she's going to be partial to black reporters so they can have access, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I don't think you should make that statement. I think that you can. Harold Washington did it without saying it. You know, I mean, I used to have him on like once a month, chat with the chief when I was on WVON at night, and we take phone calls, so just he and I.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then once a month, they'd have a sort of a press gangbang at GCI when all the black press would be in the Defender and all the other radio station reporters and newspapers. And there'd be a round table and he'd answer questions. But he never made a statement that I'm going to, give preferential treatment to black reporters.
Yeah.
But the understanding in Chicago, and I think it's always been like that with the mayor, is that if you're a black reporter, you'll never get that really inside track like some of the white reporters would get with the mayor, other than Harold. I mean, whether it was the old man Daley, even young Daley, or Jane Byrne, any of those people. I mean, it was always, you get what you can and you try to get in and get your little questions in and see if you can get access.
Did you have the feeling when you were talking to Harold Washington that he tailored what he said for a black audience? Like if he was on your show at VON, do you think his rhetoric was different to that audience? And let's say if he went, and we were talking about WGN, so let's say if he went on the Wally Phillips show on WGN.
And you know that's true. I mean, he's the ultimate politician, you know what I mean? He knew which side the bread was buttered on, you know what I mean? And so he was very good with it. I mean, he was very smooth with that. But he understood. He was a politician to his core, and he came up in the Democratic machine. He knows what to say in terms of, dealing with the press, whether it's minority press or whether it's a white press. I mean, he still made his points, and he let it be known that, he was definitely aggressive about things that were black in nature, but he also let people know that I'm the mayor of the city of Chicago, and so I'm going to address all of that and your problems as well, but I'm not going to shy away from the fact that I'm black and I'm going to deal with those issues. So he knew how to tailor what he had to say. I mean, he
tailored it. Well, I have to say this about Harold Washington. Everybody knows he's my favorite mayor. and you're in my room, so there's pictures of Harold all over the place in this room. And part of the reason I will admit this is because he treated me as a baby reporter back in those days, with like, he gave me time and attention because I was with an outfit called The Reporter, which was,
yeah, I remember The Reporter. Reporter.
John McDermott was the publisher, and it was
absolutely,
it dedicated itself to racial issues, and he took serious that publication, and no, like, he would give me interviews, you know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, and I'm sure he knew the background, McDermott and The Reporter. Yeah. He knew about The Reporter, and so he didn't go into a situation blindly, you know what I mean? I'm sure he had all the facts before he made any moves at all, and so, not taking anything away from you as a reporter, but he kind of knew what the landscape was about, you know what I mean? He made good decisions in that instance,
yeah.
You know? the council wars with Ian Vodoliak, that was... I think he played that right, because the reality there was, and I was told by somebody that he and Vodoliak weren't all that angry with each other off the political scene. And I don't know if that's true or not. I used to work with a guy named Ty Wansley, who was a news guy.
Great Ty Wansley.
And Ty Wansley and Vodoliak did a talk show on WLS together, right? And so, yeah, mm-hmm. I spoke at his funeral, as a matter of fact. But, you know... he told me some things about Vodoliak, because he traveled with him. He went to Florida and some other places, and he said Vodoliak would not let anybody mistreat him from a racial standpoint, and invited him to go places with him. And he was very, and I've also heard this about Vodoliak a lot. He was very loyal to people he was loyal to. He was loyal to them. You know what I mean? He was always about power and money, as opposed to being about race. If race will get you there,
that's
he would
the
do
point.
It, you know what I mean?
That's the point.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. See, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's the point about Vodoliak. Vodoliak put out that message. I'm not prejudiced. I personally am not prejudiced. And Robert Shaw, so many black politicians from the South Side who've dealt with Vodoliak, Vodoliak was their friend. Vodoliak was not prejudiced, not racist. But at some point, Richard, I don't care. If you're going to use racism.
Sure.
As a vehicle.
And he did.
To gain power.
Yeah.
I don't care if you're really, you know what I mean? It's like, if you're a white person facing racism in Chicago, it's like you either are doing everything you can to conquer it or defeat it or minimize it, or you're exploiting it. You know what I'm saying? I don't care what's in your, I don't care if you're Mother Teresa in your heart. You know what I'm saying? If the practice is that you're trying to get white people afraid of black people all to gain more power for yourself, then what's the point? You get what I'm saying? I don't see a distinction. They always should tell me, Ed Burke really hates black people, but Vodoliak doesn't hate black people. He's just using race. Oh, does that make it better?
So it ends up being the same thing, right?
That's my point.
Because I could never, Burke was interesting in that he and his wife adopted a black kid. I never could figure that out, you know what I mean? Because... I never viewed Burke as anything but racist. I just never did, you know. So I don't, maybe that was his wife. She was a judge and she was a Illinois Supreme Court and all of that. So I don't know what that was about. But I do think, in regard to your remark about, people who play the race card or people who don't say anything, well, you know, it's kind of, look at the Chicago Police Department, all right? All police obviously are not bad. So how do you feel about, and being a policeman is a different situation, but what about people who observe all of these things that are taking place that are totally wrong, and you're a cop, but you don't want to speak up on it? I mean, you know it's wrong. Even white officers who say, oh, that's awful, you know what I mean? And, you know, one of the Chicago police officers who was an active police officer was at January 6th. You
yes.
know about that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I know, man. That's deep. Yeah.
So I agree with you, though. I mean, if you're going to use the race card to say that Vodoliak was okay with black people, but he used the race card in any instance that, you know.
Yeah, and I knew Ty, and he's a great guy, and he had me on his show. God bless him. Anyone who put a lefty like me on their show, I always had sympathy for them, you know, empathy for them, whatever. But
Ty and I worked together, yeah. You know, on a number of occasions, and the guy was a really nice guy, but he was kind of a go-along, get-along guy. I mean, he always was, you know. My wife used to say, she'd say about Ty Wansley, she'd say, well, and she and I had to get into an argument about that because he was a good friend of mine. And she'd say, well, you know how Ty has no opinion. The sky is blue. That's his,
you know,
but he was good at his job. He did really what he did, you know, and he did his homework and he was really good. So,
and like I said, he brought me on his show. So I got nothing but love for him. All right. You raised something. And by the way, folks, this is just riffing. We're at the mic. I've never been so close to a man in my entire life.
Me either. Except my dad, you know, and he ain't my dad, you know.
So you mentioned something. You talked about police officers looking the other way at evidence of something bad going down.
Sure.
All right. And I thought a lot about this. You know, how far would any of us go? Ratting out. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because, I mean, these people have to have your back. And so... You know, that you can get taken out of the game totally by that, you know, if you do that. I mean, it's a tough thing. To me, if you're not going to resign from the police force and take another job, if you do that, you are going to be in a lot of trouble. I mean, there's no question about it. So that's a tough decision to make, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. You
want to be Serpico?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you just stole my mind. Yeah. The great Al Pacino flick, Serpico, I urge everybody to watch it if you haven't seen it already. The man paid a huge price based on a true story. He testified openly about police corruption in New York City, and essentially was banished from the. And we saw it here in Chicago when Danny Solis, the alderman of the 25th Ward, when it was revealed that he was wearing a mic and secretly taping. The other alderman basically called him a rat, and they're like closer to Burke than they are to Solis.
Well, yeah, and part of that, part of that is it was financial because. You know, Burke had a big fundraiser. Remember, even when I think this was after he was indicted.
Yeah.
And everybody showed up and everybody paid homage because he had a lot of clout. And, you know, they figured, I mean, he had a lot of clout. He was like major. So a lot of them figured, well, I'd rather stay on this side of it. I think they were just kind of like with Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'll stay. But that was awful. I mean, you know, the fact that the alderman decided to do it. It's kind of like in the U.S. Congress, and I don't want to go completely into another topic, but let me ask you this question. I'm going to take this for a minute.
Go ahead.
Regarding January 6th, mm-hmm. and the Senate said no to a commission to investigate. A
bipartisan commission investigate.
Bipartisan commission.
Was clearly an insurrection. Right, go ahead.
If I'm the Republicans, and I honestly believe that Antifa was part of it, and it was FBI undercover, and blah, 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 and all those things that they're saying, and that a large part of that crowd were people who were just, you know, faking it, wearing trunk stuff and all that. Well, then I'd say, as a Republican, let's have the investigation so we can prove that. I'm not that smart, but doesn't that kind of make sense to you? When you say, we don't want to look at it, don't want to investigate it, but I'm making all these claims. Well, have the investigation. Prove the claims. Yeah. Let's do that. Maybe you're right, you know?
Yeah. No, I know. I maybe you're right. I know what you're saying when you say that. And you have he's got a devilish grin on his face because, but you're absolutely correct. If they wanted to get to the bottom of what went down.
And prove the things that they're saying.
Exactly. Then here's your chance.
Yeah.
And you always, they like when it comes to their made up allegations of voter fraud, they're still recounting votes in Arizona. So, like, they go to no ends to try to prove that there was voter fraud that didn't exist. But here's the reality with January 6th.
Which is, by the way, my birthday.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I did that. Yeah.
I'll always remember that, you know what I mean?
There's no correlation, ladies and gentlemen, between what went down in the Capitol and Richard Steele's birthday. Richard Steele just turned 43. In his last
Oh, yeah, year. Really?
You're around 43.
Yeah, okay. Leave it there. It's cool.
The Republicans, listen, this is the deal with the Republicans. I'm a humble opinion. Get your opinion on this. The Republican Party realizes that Donald Trump has led them to a point of lawlessness.
Right.
That Donald Trump has been fabricating evidence of a stolen election, fabricating it, it's non-existent, that Donald Trump riled up a group of true believers, MAGA followers, to go take the Capitol and intimidate Congress into electing Donald Trump, overriding the will of the voters into electing Donald Trump. And they were literally intimidating. They were saying, Michael Pence, you have the gavel. You do your job or we're going to hang you. Literally, that's what happened on January 6th. We saw it. We heard it. We know it went down. If the Republican Party were to come face to face with enacting consequences for the people who stirred up that insurrection, that would mean that they would go after Donald Trump himself. And he is worshipped by roughly 80% of the Republican Party.
Listen, McCarthy got that phone call.
Yes.
He made the phone call. Help, we need help. And he said this, but you know, he doesn't want to get subpoenaed because you'd have to tell the truth.
Yes.
But I mean, it's...
So they want it to go away,
It's sort of in-your-face stuff. Yeah. I mean, it's not even hidden, you know?
They want it to go away. They don't want an investigation. They want it to go away.
And I think in 2 years, it's not going to go away for the midterms. The Democrats, the other thing about the Democrats, so Democrats to me, you know, they play fair. They, you know, like you need to man up. You know what I mean? I think like James Carville has said on many occasions, you know, you got to play the game to win. You know what I mean? And they don't always do that. And I think that's a loss for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm happy to see that Nancy Pelosi, I don't know if you saw this, the House is going to do its own investigation.
Right. She's too sharp. She's really sharp.
Yeah.
You know.
And so they're going to force the issue. And so the Republicans are going to be in a position where they're constantly defending Trump, are constantly undercutting the significance of what went down January 6th. They really just want people to forget about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, and these are the same people that had the Benghazi hearings that Hillary Clinton did for how many hours, you know, of testimony, and they didn't touch her. No, you know what I mean? So, that was a Senate committee was, you know, not bipartisan.
No, if you're going to look for consistency in principles, you're not going to find it in the Republican Party. This is my point all along. They're a tactical party. They follow whatever strategy they need at that moment, and that's it. There is no overriding principle that governs them. It's merely what they can do at that moment to win the next election.
But do you think there's a miscalculation here? I mean, because a number of things have happened. Obviously, the voter laws that many of these states have put into the mix is going to make a difference. You see the announcement today with the Attorney General.
Yes.
The Department of Justice is going to take a very close look at that in terms
at
of
Georgia.
The laws. There's a lawsuit, as a matter of fact, at this point. But I just wonder whether or not in the next election, will all of this action and all the press it's gotten, will that spur even more people to come out to vote? I mean, and say, you know, if you have the Democrats have a lot of activity behind the campaigns and saying like this is even more important than the last one. You really need to show up. You need to come out. Blah blah blah. And also, there'll be more people watching. You know, even though in some states like Georgia, the officials said this is the most honest election we ever had.
Yeah.
You know, this is problem free.
Yeah.
And so, I'm just wondering, will it make some kind of a difference in 2 years? In terms of spurring voters, some voters even more so than this last time.
I don't know. That's a really tough.
Because the Republicans are looking at it like, Donald Trump got over 70 million votes.
Yeah.
So they're looking at it like, we don't want to lose these people, you know what I mean? But they're also looking at, like General Milley, you see what he said yesterday?
No,
what he said. I'm a white guy, he said, and you know, like, I want to understand what is the rage? What is the source of the rage?
Yeah.
Well, the Republicans, as you point out, very calculating. They know that looking at the demographics, that, you know, there's a demographic shift that's going to happen in relatively short time with people of color. And so they can tap into white rage about that. And they got a guy like Trump who sort of can represent that kind of thinking. And because Trump doesn't care about it. He doesn't give a shit about conservatism or about...
Donald Trump is about Donald Trump.
Donald
Trump is about Donald Trump from start to finish.
That's it. But, and trust me, if he thinks that Weisselberg is going to flip He will definitely throw Weisselberg under the bus.
Oh, now you're talking about one of our dear friend Monroe Anderson's favorite topics, and this is the financial person at Trump, right. Business empire, who's under a lot of pressure from prosecutors in New York City to testify as to what he knows about Donald Trump's business affairs. We'll just leave it at that. And Monroe's theory is that he has the knowledge and the ability to bring Donald Trump down.
Sure.
To do to Donald Trump, let's say what Danny Solis could do to Ed Burke. Okay. For all I know, he's been wearing a wire. You know, I do not know that, but
you'd think he'd have some kind of insurance. You'd think maybe not wearing a wire, but something else. But here's the deal. I wrote something on Facebook. I don't know if you read it. I wrote a thing on Facebook. I said, well, you're hearing it here first. And that is a matter of fact that, trust me on this, if Weisselberg decides he's going to testify, he will either have an unexplained heart attack and die. He will either get hit by a hit-and-run driver, or he will fall out of a window, a 10-story building, an open window. I mean, it's kind of like...
In other words, you think that Trump is a mobster.
Look, I mean, he's got all the information, you know, and so I can't imagine Trump not making a move of some kind if Weisselberg, because Weisselberg knows all the stuff, you know?
Yeah, no.
Jeffrey Epstein, you know, he just check out, well, Trump's not going to kill himself, but he, and Epstein didn't either. I mean, this
wait,
guy
time out.
Is,
do you think Jeffrey Epstein killed himself?
No.
Do you think, okay.
No. I mean, I think that's, any reasonably intelligent person would say no. That's, he had all this information on all these people. And in order to keep doing a lot of jail time, if they're going to press him, you know, look, we can reduce almost to nothing if you, but you got to give us some news and some people and some names. He had all the names.
Yeah.
And so he's not going to live.
Yeah.
He's not going to live.
Yeah.
He hanged himself in his cell.
Yeah.
Please give me a break.
And the guards just happened not to
happened
be watching.
To, no, weren't watching, you know, at that point. So I think in terms of Trump in that same situation, I don't think Trump is going to do anything to himself because his vanity wouldn't allow him to. I mean, he has no conscience and no moral center, nothing, you know. But about throwing you under the bus, he had no problem with that at all.
Oh, that's dumb.
Because his defense is going to be, as his lawyers are saying, if they shift it to the thing about, you know, because he never put anything on paper. He didn't write anything. He didn't make any notes.
Yeah.
And so if he can shift it to, look, that's what Weisselberg was doing this stuff, and I didn't know anything about it. You know, he was on his own with that. Well, even if you don't buy that, there's nothing, if there's nothing on paper, you know what I mean? You know, even if he signed some shit, he can say, I just signed it. You know, I didn't know.
Tax statements.
Yeah.
He just, oh, yeah, the boss just signed this right here. Try that one with the jury. New York jury. Try that one with a New York jury, Richard. You know, I don't think that's going to fly.
Now, let me ask you a question about something else. We didn't talk about this yet.
Okay.
Lakeshore Drive and the naming it after DuSable.
All right. Well,
which is another issue at City Council that Lori Lightfoot is dealing with.
Yeah. As we speak, the council, or maybe they've already completed. So there's a compromise. I was just talking about this with someone before you came over. There's a compromise where they'll call it DuSable
Lakeshore Drive. Right. Yeah.
So, okay, I'm going to tell you how I feel about it. Get your thoughts
on
this one. I thought this was, how do I put this? An absurd controversy. I did not see, like, naming it the Outer Drive for DuSable, the official name, does not cause anyone to have to stop calling it Lakeshore Drive.
Mm-hmm.
If you, Richard Steele, a lifelong Chicagoan, want to spend the rest of your life calling it Lakeshore Drive, it's not like they're going to throw you in jail. And I always point out, like, I don't know anybody.
Sears Tower.
There you go.
We still call it.
And right now, I'm going to put it to you. This man is a Southsider. He went to Hirsch High School on the South Side. He's South Side his whole life. It was nice of him to come to the North Side to do this show, but he's a South Sider. Name right now For 10 trivia points, the official name of the ballpark where the Chicago White Sox
play. I knew you were going to ask me that.
Yeah. You can't do it.
I have no idea. I really have no idea. I really don't. Your point.
Guarantee right field. Nobody knows the name of it. The only reason I know the name of it, I've been to two games this year. They got the ridiculous sign up there. And Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox, said he cut the deal. He got the money from Guarantee Rate. And then he said, he goes, you want to call it Comiskey Park? Call it Comiskey Park. If you want to call it White Sox Park, call it Comiskey Park. If you want to call it Sell, that was with the last deal he cut, I don't care. You know, basically. So it's like, why? Then the people go, Ben, you don't understand. We've branded that as part of our identity. And then Neil Steinberg actually put this in the paper today, which I just didn't buy it. Like people, it's a positive view that people have of Chicago. Like people will come to Chicago because of Lakeshore Drive. Richard Steele, I don't believe you can find one person in the world who has come to Chicago because it's called Lakeshore Drive. And we used to have, we used to have something called Maxwell Street. And you know what Maxwell Street is because you're a Chicagoan. I know what Maxwell Street is because it was still around when I came here. And that was that flea market. Every Sunday you go buy stuff at Maxwell. Mayor Richard Daley thought it was ugly and he got rid of Maxwell Street. And literally there were people who identified Chicago with Maxwell Street. So if you were going to use the argument that there are things in Chicago that tourists love, that bring tourists to, think about it. The Blues Brothers movie with Belushi and Aykroyd, there was that scene in Maxwell Street. You remember where Franklin was the waitress at the restaurant? They got rid of Maxwell Street like that. I didn't hear one person, except for a bunch of lefties like myself, talking about how Maxwell Street has an international appeal and a ring.
And the whole series of blues guys who got their start, singing on Maxwell Street in front of a crowd,
yeah.
You know, getting some bucks, getting a few dollars here and there. But I mean, some who became very famous because Maxwell Street, that was the place where people went, you know. And I remember as a kid, I used to go over there and shop for real cheap stuff and get, you know, it would look good in school, you know what I mean? And took my little paper out money and went over there and got some stuff, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, you're right. It was, Maxwell Street was definitely a draw for Chicago. But, you know, the development thing took over, the idea about developing the area, and they did, and they eliminated Maxwell Street. And the little area they have now where they have, you know, it's just terrible. I've been over there,
yeah,
and it's nothing. I mean, it really isn't, comparatively speaking.
Yeah, to what Maxwell Street was. So that's my point. It's like they pick and choose what they consider like great traditions in the city of Chicago. And you know what? Naming the street for the black guy, I'm like, what's the matter with that?
So look, I'm in favor of what you said. You wanted to know what I thought. I thought that DuSable Lakeshore Drive is fine. You know, I don't have a problem with that. That's the compromise. Lori Lightfoot wants, in addition to, if she signs onto that, she wants to change Millennium Park, the name of Millennium, also Riverwalk. Look, just go with DuSable Lakeshore Drive and leave it at that.
You know what I mean? No, it's overkill. Just now they're naming everything for DuSable.
She just can't. It doesn't seem like she really kind of knows what to do, or she makes bad decisions.
Yeah.
When looking at the entire picture, and she says, "Well, I think I'll do this." No, that's a bad idea. You know, nobody's advising her. Nobody that I know.
By the way, that was a slick move though that she pulled. We had fun with this one, Richard, for many weeks. I think for 2 weeks. At the last meeting, or two meetings ago, Sophia King, the alderwoman of the 4th Ward, and David Moore, the alderman of the 17th Ward, had the votes, apparently, to approve the name change. Now, I don't think they could. They had the votes to override a Mayor Lori Lightfoot veto, but they claimed they had the votes. And so at that crucial moment at the meeting where Sophia King was moving to have a roll call, instead of recognizing Sophia King to call for a roll call, Mayor Lori Lightfoot pretended that somebody else had his hand up first. And so she went with Brian Hopkins, and he asked to defer and publish and postpone. And there's, you know, tape that we play all the time of Sophia King said, "Come on, Madam President, you're better than that.
Don't even try it."
Yeah. So that gave her the time to buy the compromise, so that she didn't have to go through the veto process. And I would have had, I don't know, I would have greater respect for Lori Lightfoot. She let the vote go down. She loses and she vetoes it, gives her reason why she vetoed it. You know what I'm saying? Whatever your reason is, why you're against it, explain it. And then see if the other side can override her.
I mean, she doesn't seem to have any wins at this point. You know, like the state, I think it was the state of Illinois, decided that we'd have an elected, I mean, an elected school board. You know, so, well, anyway, look, let's move on to something
else. This is the next topic I wanted to ask you about, crime. And
are you asking me about crime because I'm black? No, I'm just kidding.
We're awfully close to each other. Did I tell you about that? The man is literally right next to me. So there's no crime being committed here. Speaking of crime and black people, Eric Adams was just elected.
He hasn't been elected yet.
You're right. I said corrected. He was the what looks like he was the winner.
He's the front runner.
Yeah, they have that rank voting system. So I said
you're talking about the mayor of New York City.
Yes, correct. He ran as a law and order candidate,
right?
Very much against defund the police. And he also ran, pointing out the obvious, that he's a black man in New York City and he's been harassed by police. And so he's going to be vigilant to protect black citizens of New York from that kind of harassment. But at the same time, he's not going to be for defund the police. He's going to be for cracking down on criminals and throwing them in jail. And he won. Richard, last I saw the article I sent you, I think he won over 50% of the black
vote. Got the larger percentage of the vote. And so he probably will end up being mayor, which will be, the second black mayor? Dinkins was the first one. Yeah. So that's an interesting situation. And let me ask you what you think about this. The policies that happened under Rudy Giuliani, the broken window policies and the stop and frisk, were objectionable to a lot of people, especially if you're black or Hispanic. But the crime rate went down at that point. Is that just a matter of timing in terms of what was happening crime-wise in the city, or does he deserve any credit for that, even though the thing harassed a lot of black people and a lot of Hispanic people, and it really got totally out of hand, you know? So, it's something to think about. What do you think?
Well, it's if you're going to have a real serious discussion about crime, you have to take a look at long-term trends. And so the Giuliani years, crimes started to fall in New York City, but it continued to fall after Giuliani.
Sure, absolutely.
And it fell into the de Blasio years, and he was the mayor who said he was going to stop and frisk, and he did stop and frisk. And so, Richard, my general sense of this, I'm helpless on this issue. And what I mean is, I don't believe I've ever read or seen anyone articulate a policy that can be followed that would clearly established that it reduces crime. And I say this as a guy who's lived in Chicago since 81. And ever since I've been living in Chicago, there's been moments in Chicago where they do the equivalent of what Rudy Giuliani did, mass arrests. You know, I'm in the 80s. There was a guy named McCarthy, and he was all into sweeping the streets. He was one of the top commanders.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And sweeping the streets of Chicago, just locking everybody up. And then, you know, they were locking so many black people up for marijuana possession. That was the key to get, let's sweep the, you got a joint? Boom, you're going to jail. Right, you know? Right.
So, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, but this has always been a violent city. Where is the evidence that it, like, just mass arrests does anything more than harass people?
No, I think that's been proven. I mean, you know, that policy is not a workable policy. It doesn't help anything. It doesn't change anything. I think you're absolutely right about that. It's, you know, we'll see what happens with this guy in New York, because he will win. And, you know, it'll be on him to prove what he said. You know, I mean, it's a tough job. You think being the mayor of Chicago is tough.
Yeah.
Being the mayor of New York City,
yeah.
You know, which encompasses like five little cities. Those boroughs are like cities, you know.
Yeah, but he...
He's from Brooklyn, where I was born, you know. So
I forgot that. You told me that once. You were born in Brooklyn. How did you end up in Chicago?
It's a long, boring story. But I think I came here when I was about nine. But the difference with me and other kids in school was that for black kids, every summer, in my generation, black kids would go back to see their grandparents in Mississippi and Arkansas and, you know, point south. I always went to Brooklyn during the summer with my grandparents and played stickball. So when school started again, what did you do over your summer vacation? My story was always totally different. They'd look at me and say, what's wrong with it? Yeah.
I'm trying to, you don't really have a New York accent.
Well, that was a problem for me. I'm glad you mentioned that. When I came here as a kid, and because I used to go back every summer, when I came here, I had a mixture of, because my grandparents are from the West Indies, from Barbados. And so I had a mixture of West Indian and New York. And the first school I went to, I had a teacher, I'll never forget this. I had a teacher who escorted me personally to another room to have another teacher hear me talk, because they never heard anybody like that. Because all the kids, most of the parents and everybody's from the South.
Yeah.
And so here's this kid who sounds like a mixture between West Indian and New York, and they were listen to him, you know, like, and so it was, I'll never forget that. It was kind of demeaning. I didn't really totally understand what that was about at the time, but I'll never forget that, because I was sort of like on public display.
Just, how long did it take you to lose that accent?
A long time, because I never really, my mother, who was also born in Brooklyn, when she came to Chicago, she readily adopted a Southern accent. I mean, I used to say, I can't believe you really sound like that. Yeah. But I never did. Not purposely. I just didn't, you know, it just didn't work for me. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, too, even with a little embarrassment when I was a kid, I think at the end of the day, that combination of factors for me proved good for me in radio. You know, it gave me more of a general sound.
Yeah.
You know, and so that was good.
Yeah. Well, my father has a similar story. He's from Arkansas, rural Arkansas, and the family moved to Philly when he was about 13 or so, something like that. And they looked at him like a creature from Mars.
He was a good old Southern kid, huh?
Yeah, I had that Southern. Yeah. The family moved around a lot, but they were like, huh, who is this guy? And he was calling the teachers ma'am, and they go, you know, sir, and they go, we don't do that up here. You know what I mean? He was used to that Southern thing. He got over it really fast. But
you know, there was some language things too, because in Chicago, when I was a kid, like if you wanted to get a quart of milk, they call it sweet milk here in Chicago. I was like, really? Does it have sugar in it? No, this sweet milk. Just get a carton of sweet milk. And also on the East Coast with New York and Boston and some other places, it's called soda. It's called pop here in Chicago. Soda, you know what I mean? Yeah, so And so I'd say things and people look at me and say, well, what is he talking about? You know?
All right. Now, before we completely switch gears, the sentencing hearing, who was convicted, is starting. So it's happening right now. So
it
may be finished and completed before we're, I got it set to the New York Times here, and it hasn't happened. They haven't had Derek Chauvin yet. They can watch it live. So I don't know if we'll have an opportunity to talk about it. So let's switch topics again, more to the cultural side of things. And I had a revelation, ladies and gentlemen, over the last month or so about Richard Steele. I've known this man for a while, and I did not know that Richard Steele was a basketball fan. I always thought Richard Steele was a music guy, a politics guy, that you weren't into sports at all.
Love basketball.
And to my shock and amazement, he is a diehard basketball fan, probably as deeply rooted in the sport as I am, which says a lot.
Not quite as much as you, but, you know, if anybody can do that.
I know is that every night I get a text or two or three from Rich. I have a whole group of friends, Richard, that I text during basketball games, because they're watching the game.
Okay.
And you are now on that list. So talk a little bit about that.
Just
kept that a secret.
These young guys are so good. I mean, it's kind of like not just one team, because the one team with all the great players, guys got injured. So, you know, the Nets ran up against the wall. They got these three great guys, but you have an injury. And that's it. Kevin Durant was just incredible. Nobody can play like that for that period of time, playing a whole game and trying to save the team. But the reality is about basketball at this point, all these other teams have got split up. They have these guys who, who are just absolute Kawhi and the Greek Freak And the kid in Atlanta, Trey Young. Yeah. Jesus, I've never seen. He was, and the deal with him, this is my thinking too. The other night when Paul George missed, he made it up last night. But he missed those two free throws, which would have sort of guaranteed them the game. And I said to you by text, when you get paid that much money, you don't miss those free throws. That's what you're paid for.
Yeah.
Really. The flip side of that is when I think about Trae Young, even nights that he did not have a good night, he made, the necessary. He never misses a free throw, and he contributed at the end of the game by putting them in the place they needed to be. So these young guys are just, some of them are just so incredible.
All right, so I want to go back to the free throw thing because that's actually where I wanted to go. So first of all, I was surprised that Richard was a basketball fan. I got over that. I've accepted him. He's proved it, his knowledge, that he is really a legit basketball fan. Okay, so then what caught me off guard, and I'm going to set this up, ladies and gentlemen, it was a very exciting back-and-forth game between the Los Angeles Clippers and the Phoenix Suns, and the Clippers had been down the whole game at the last 2 minutes, led by Paul George. They had this comeback and they took the lead. It was desperation time for the Suns. They intentionally fouled Paul George to put him on the line just to stop the clock and get the ball back. The Clippers were up by one. If he hits two free throws, pretty much guarantees at least an overtime game because the Suns can only prevail by hitting a three-pointer.
Right.
He missed both free throws. And I was rooting for the Clippers. I'm like, you're kidding me, right?
And just to let this audience know, Ben Jarofsky sent me a text and said, I know the guy is hurt. No, feeling sorry for the guy. I'm like, nah. I'm like Shaq on that one, although I didn't see the conversation on that one. But, Shaq doesn't give anybody any leeway at all. He was a guy who couldn't make free throws at all.
Well, basically, in this situation, Richard Steele was Eric Adams, and I was Maya Wiley. And I'm Maya Wiley, the lefty who finished second in the New York race. Come on, let's just have a heart and passion for the people who do wrong. And Richard's like, throw him in jail, throw the book out.
Yeah, I mean, for that much money, both free throws, Ben, that's what it's called, a free throw. Michael Jordan was death on that when people started missing free throws.
Well, anyway. I will just tell you this about Michael.
But he would stay in the gym for in practice and shoot 100 free throws.
As a diehard Bulls fan, I remember Michael Jordan missed a crucial free throw. This shows the depth of my knowledge, and it's really a cry for help, Richard. In 1989, in a playoff game against the Cavs, he missed a free throw that would have sealed the victory for the Bulls and would have won the series out. Instead, it went to a final, a game five, decisive game. Those games, five, best of five, in Cleveland. And that was the game where he hit the shot at the buzzer to win the game over Craig Elo and go to the next round. One of the greatest shots in his career. But he has said this. He would not have had that moment of utter greatness and triumph if he had not had a moment of failure.
Okay.
Before, and he was crying in the locker room. And I remember the Reverend Jesse Jackson, somehow or other, explain to me, Richard, how Reverend Jesse Jackson always gets these passes. He was in the locker room comforting Michael Jordan after he missed that free throw. So,
I mean, it can happen, but it just seems so immediate in this situation where, he only had like seconds left in the game and the guy's at the free throw line. He's a great shooter and good player, better than average player. I mean, he's a main guy.
Yeah.
And you miss one. Yeah. But both, when he missed the second one, I went, oh, no, he didn't do that. Hell no. He didn't miss the second one.
I don't know how he missed it. And you know what? Now, here's a question. Now we're doing basketball. So I'm watching the game with my wife. Paul George goes to the free throw line. And my wife says, he's going to make them both. And he went and missed them both. Now, I'm going to ask you this, Richard. Am I illogical and irrational when I say, her saying that jinxed Paul George?
that's kind of like when the basketball guys who are doing color for the game, right?
Yeah.
Every time they say, well, so-and-so, he's really great at three-pointers or So and so, he's made like 11 of those. He's amazing. Next one, he misses.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, you ever notice that?
Yeah, I notice that. Yeah, that's why I've learned over the years, don't say anything to the reality, I know, ladies and gentlemen, that what I say to my wife or what she says to me in the comfort of our home, all the way across the country from the game is being played, has no effect
at all
whatsoever.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
You know,
but you do kind of feel like, oh, you said that and look what happened. You know what I mean?
It's like the butterfly effect. Somehow or other, her saying that influenced everything.
You do feel like that. Oh, by the way, one other note on that, on basketball, period. The Bulls got nobody in the draft. I mean, they got zero, nothing in the draft. And then there was some talk about, I don't know if you read this, about in a series of trades, it might end up with us getting Ben Simmons.
Do you think that?
I mean.
Well, okay, now, guys. All right, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Simmons is an outstanding player for the Philadelphia 76ers who has a problem of he is really in a mental funk over his inability to shoot. He's afraid he's afraid to shoot the ball because he's afraid of getting fouled because he's afraid of having to go to the free throw line. And so he's in a funk. If you can overcome that psychological challenge that he has, he could be an outstanding basketball player that could help the Bulls. The question is, do you think the Bulls have... I think he needs a therapist, man.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you know, who knows what makes you step up? You know, I mean, sometimes you develop as a player, but as you pointed out, he's got all these psychological things that are jamming him, you know, because Jimmy Buckets wasn't a star when he came Jimmy here. Butler, yeah. And but he's a hell of a player, you know what I mean?
So he may overcome it.
He may overcome it. Because it's like the Greek freak Giannis, when he goes to the free throw line, you always go, okay, he's going to miss both of them or at least one of them. And he has to really concentrate to try to do that. As great a player as he is, he cannot make free throws.
I mean, he is better than Ben Simmons.
He's better than Ben Simmons. Good. Ben Simmons is terrible.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's awful.
I feel for the guy when he goes to the line. He's awful. Got that look.
You know, you kind of know, okay, he's going to miss.
Yeah.
He's going to feel bad. I'm going to feel bad for him.
Oh, and then the fans in Philly are just booing him.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, boo!
Hey, these guys get paid a lot of money. You know what I mean? And so... speaking of that, one other thing about basketball. What about the Supreme Court's decision about paying?
About time. Company?
It is about time. It is about time.
About
billions,
time.
It's a billion-dollar industry in terms of college basketball and football. $1 billion.
Yeah. No, it's about time. I welcome it. It's the first step toward paying college players a salary for the sports they play, and it's also the first step of really breaking up the complete control that the NCAA has over the life of players.
I mean,
it's a modern day, it's indentured servitude is what it is, and it's about time we break it up.
And the bottom line to that is, in terms of the overall picture, is that only about, I think it's between 5 and 8% of all the kids who play in college get to play pro ball. It's not even
10, yeah, so,
it's not,
yeah,
it's not exactly. even 10%. Yeah. You know?
So, all right, we'll close with the challenge I throw to you. It's the 50-year anniversary of what they claim is one of the great years for music. I have since come to the conclusion that it's kind of hype and there are other years. but whatever, let's Mick Dumke and I did a whole show on our favorite songs in 1971. And Richard Steele knows music. He knows all kinds of music. He's been a disc jockey in jazz. Popular music, soul music, R&B, et cetera, and so forth. So in your humble opinion.
Here we go.
The drum roll, please. I'll give you three. What are the three greatest songs of 1971? Or the three greatest albums, if you want to go in that direction?
Well, I don't know about the others. I don't go back that far in terms of my memory. I'm old now, and so I don't remember stuff. But to me, the greatest recording in that year was, without question, was Marvin Gaye, What's Going On. I mean, the lyrics in those songs are relevant today about name it, you know, racism, the police, the ecology. I mean, how do you get all that in one? And you know that Rolling Stone just voted that album number one. That was fantastic. And the other song that I said to you was a big song because you like James Brown.
Yeah.
what was the song?
You tell it to me and I'll read it right now. I can't remember.
Talk
about memory. Here we go. Richard Steele. Hot Pants.
Hot Pants, yeah, right, right, right. Hot Pants, yeah. That was a big record, a really big record, you know. So
were you working in Chicago and a radio station?
71, yeah, I was.
Which one? Fact.
I was working at WGRT at that point, which later became WJPC when Johnson bought it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I met James Brown twice. Once when I was working in Roanoke, Virginia, my first job, and his show came to town, and I was going out with a girl who, and I didn't have any money. I was broke. I was making like $80 a week. $160 every 2 weeks, which came to $128 every 2 weeks. So the lady I was going out with, she said, I really want to see James Brown. Well, we got tickets at the radio station. It wasn't the rock station was the one that, you know, they were bringing the show in. So she said, I really want to go. I said, yeah, but I'm depressed. I don't have any money. And, but she wanted to go, so we went. After the show, James Brown came to the area. It was a brand new stadium and a performance center. And he came back and introduced himself. And he said, you know, I wanted to meet everybody. You know, we shook his hand. And we were all impressed because all his people had these great fur coats on. And they were, you know, really sharp and all of that. And then he said, when he got ready to leave, he said, oh, what happened with that too was one of our guys was smoking and put a cigarette out on the floor. And he said, he went to pick it up. He said, no, we don't want to do that because we don't want these white people to say that, you know, we came and did some things and left some garbage and all of that because it was a brand new place. And so I was impressed with that. But the other part of the being impressed, he said, I want y'all to, in a minute, go back in that room, and this is Mr. Bobbitt. See Mr. Bobbitt back in the room, you know. So, and we went to see Mr. Bobbitt. I think it was about four of us, and I had heard they always gave out some money, but I said, you know, why would they do that here? We're in Roanoke, Virginia. Yeah. Nobody gives a damn about whether we play the record or not. We went back in the room, and Charles Bobbitt. He said, he had a book, you know, he had a little book, and he said, you know, I think he gave everybody like $150, which was huge at that point for me. So he said, well, you know, like this time, sign this book, you know, you receive the money. So nobody wrote their right name in the book. You know what I mean? We were smart enough to know that, you know what I mean? And but the thinking behind that for James Brown is, and I met him years later when I was program director at WJPC, was that when he went to these little towns, he knew people weren't making any money. And so when they dole out that little cash, you never know where this person is going to be later on. At a later point, I'm a program director, music director in Chicago.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it makes a difference. And he did that all across the country. You know what I mean?
So it's cold cash, not a check.
Oh, yeah, cold cash, right. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, Richard Steele has just confessed to payola.
Oh, absolutely.
But I believe the statute of limitations
has run out. Right.
And part of the story that he has not told is that the name he wrote back in 1971, was Ben Jarofsky. He put my name in that book. that's a great story, man. You got to meet James Brown, and you got paid for it. So
the second time he offered me a ride in his jet, his airplane at that point. He came and he saw Mr. Johnson. Johnson called me up in the office, and he said, you know, I just wanted to meet James Brown. And I told him, I said, you probably don't remember, but I met you when I was in Roanoke, Virginia. And he said, yeah. Barry, he remembered the owner's name, Barry, whatever his name, he remembered that. And he said, yeah, well, that's nice. That was back in the day, you know. And I remembered it because he wanted a record put on like right away, his new record. And so I said to him, I said, well, Mr. Brown, he had to call him Mr. I said, Mr. Brown, we change the record list once a week. And, you know, that's coming up. We'll probably, we change it on Wednesday. It's like Monday. I said, we change it on Thursday. So he said, yeah, but I want you to hear it. So we went downstairs to the station. We listened to the record. And it was a good record. It was one of his great big hits, right? But it was a good, he didn't put out bad records.
Yeah.
So he said, well, you know, Mr. Steele, you know, put that right on. I said, no, I'm going to wait till Thursday. He said, but it'll be on. There's no question about it. He said, so then he said, well, you know what, Mr. Steele, at that point he had a television show in Atlanta. Uh-huh. And he said, well, if you're ever in Atlanta, look me up and come on by and I'll put you on the show. And you ain't got to wait till Thursday.
Well done, James Brown.
Right, exactly. You know, I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
You know.
Well done, James Brown. Oh, my God. James Brown and my mom have some things in common. You know what I mean? That ability to point out that little distinction there. I'm going to take one last look to see if there's been a verdict. And hold on. And I don't believe there has been. So we'll just have to wait until our next show. Hold on. I'm looking in real time. No verdict to be sent. So we'll have to wait for the next time to see what kind of verdict. I personally, we talked about this earlier. I think they should throw a book at him. And I think Richard, seeing how hard he is in Paul George, he's even tougher on Derek Chauvin.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But I think that realistically, he might get half of that sentence. Yeah, you know, 10 or 15 years.
You know, Richard, he looked it right in the eye, looked at the camera right in the eye, and it's like, I'm going to do this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was, you know, I mean, but think about this. Without the video, I mean, you know, and even with that, if you heard the prosecutors and the guy who used to be attorney general who was on the case.
Yeah.
And he was saying that they were all worried. I mean, there was never a moment when they weren't worried that they'd lose the case. I mean, even with the video. Yeah. So you'd have to have all of that. You'd have to have video. You have to have witnesses. You have to have the guy's track record as a police. You'd have to have all of that with the video with the guy on his knee on the guy's neck, and the guy say, "I can't breathe." You have if you didn't have all of that, and you still might have lost with all of that. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's another situation too. In talking about other police officers, there were two or three other guys there. And none of them like said, you know.
No, they didn't say anything. Yeah. They're coming up. Their trials
they're coming up.
Yeah, their trials coming up.
Yep, yep.
No, that's a very
without the video.
Without the video.
Yeah, you know.
Without the video. Yeah, we all know. All right, Richard Steele, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the show, but also for driving up to my humble little house, my humble little attic here.
It's nice, really nice. You know, nice hideaway.
Nice hideaway, and this is where I do the show. And Rich is the first person, first guest ever in this. And so maybe.
Really? Nobody's done this before?
No, we all do it virtual. And,
okay, well, I had some technical issues virtually.
We're not going to go into that. Yeah. You know, we don't have to talk about
that. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and it's a blast to have you here. And we're going to bring you back. Now that I know you don't mind driving, and Richard doesn't mind driving, by the way, it's something I've learned about him. You do not mind driving.
No, as long as it's daylight. I don't, you know, after dark, I don't drive anymore after dark.
Well, we don't do
so. We don't do the show after dark.
Yeah, yeah. So you got no problem.
So you'll be good.
So anyway, I want to thank Richard Steele for coming by, and also want to thank DJ Nate, the man, the myth, the legend. What a great job sitting in for Dr. D. Dennis on vacation. Dennis will be back next week, and I'll just repeat what I always say: DJ Nate is a DJ. He does weddings, he does parties, he does graduations, house parties, bar mitzvahs, commencements, whatever it is. He'll play old music. He'll play new music. He'll play music that I like, that Richard Steele likes, and that millennials like. He does it all.
Whatever you need.
Whatever you need. He's DJ Nate. So he's ready to DJ your party. And he did a great job for us. So DJ Nate, give yourself a raise. Take it out of petty cash. Have a great weekend, everybody.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.